This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As a pastor, Lawrence Yu has dedicated his life to helping others, and he does that by guiding people to apply their entrepreneurial ambition to community service. He put that philosophy into practice with a restaurant he co-owns in Durham called Sushioki. The Pan-Asian eatery provides living wage, flexible jobs for those in the refugee community in this triangle area. Lawrence says this kind of business model can be applied to other industries as well, including housing. Running a business this way blends his passion for ministry with his background as an entrepreneur. Lawrence spent his childhood helping his parents run various enterprises from restaurants to a market. Lawrence Yu is lead pastor at Waypoint Church in the Triangle and joins me in the studio now. Lawrence Yu, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Oh, glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about growing up. You grew up in a Korean-American community in Philadelphia, right?
That's correct.
Tell us about growing up.
Well, we grew up in a very kind of traditional Korean-American home. My parents came over when they were in the early 20s. I was born in the United States. My mom was just in the States for 1 year at that time. So I grew up in a very close-knit Korean-American immigrant community. And there was a large wave of Korean immigrants at that time.
And talk about the way, because they were involved in a number of businesses, right?
Right, yeah. My parents owned everything from a little sandwich shop to a market to dry cleaners. I always joke with them, if they opened up a nail salon, we'd hit every Korean stereotype possible of ownership. So,
But part of that is, and this business ownership, which becomes part of the stereotype if you know it at all, has to do with the way families are financed and the way financing works. Talk about that.
Yeah, this is something that I found so interesting later in life. I've always known about this system that they've had. They called it Kedon. And it's this kind of term for almost like this microloan financing system that they would do in the community. And it would take a very close-knit community to pull this off. So I don't think it would work nowadays. But back then, community was so important, they didn't have anybody else. And so what they would do is they'd gather a group of families together, and they would each put in a large amount of money a year. And that combined amount, let's just say, for example, $10,000 each family. And for 10 families, that would be $100,000. Then 1 year, they would give it to one family and say, start a business. Now, it might not be that much money. It could be less. It could be more. But that was just for example. And then that person would start a business with it. And so all these Korean families then would have opportunities to start businesses where they couldn't get loans from banks. They couldn't get the initial capital that they needed. Now they had it.
And some of this is carried over. And other cultures do this as well. And they did it in the home countries as well. These are the kinds of microfinancing that went on, sometimes for interest, sometimes just to keep the community going. But this is the way in which communities live and thrive and had for a long time in their own home cultures.
Right. And what I found so beautiful is I always wondered. I mean, I didn't know. Yeah, I knew the concept of Kedon. I knew that this happened. Growing up, I saw my parents contributing to it, receiving the money from it. But then it wasn't until I applied ideas of economics and business to, that's why Korean businesses, that's why there's so many Korean business owners.
So talk about, you're the firstborn son in your family, and your father was the firstborn son in his family, and that's significant. Lots of responsibility goes with that.
I'm guessing
some privilege, too.
Yeah. Well, my sister will say so, yes.
Okay.
No, there is. I think traditionally, very patriarchal society, being the firstborn son of the firstborn son of the firstborn son carries a lot of, you carry the name. I was probably like the golden child of the generation. My grandfather had a lot of daughters, but then he had three daughters first, then he had his son. And so it was a big deal. And I was the first born right away. So my grandfather doted on me. Didn't care as much for my other cousins. I feel bad for them. But doted on me. Mm-hmm. And I was and at that point also as well, I was kind of being groomed to be like, you carry the name. You need to be the hope of the generation in America.
Yeah, and was that any different? I suppose it's hard for you to compare because you were born here, but I wonder if that changed any. Now, as you said, born in America, and if the expectations were ratcheted up because now you're here and perhaps there's more opportunity.
You know, I think in some ways you would think culturally it's less just because the cultural responsibilities of tradition and all that stuff. But actually, in some ways, because it was in America, I think it was actually ratcheted up because you're now like, whereas they were successful in Korea, they were kind of starting from the bottom in America. And so all of a sudden, they work hard, these hard jobs, doing different things to say, okay, now you are the one we work hard, now you be the one that's successful.
Your parents decided to start over in Atlanta when you were in third grade. What happened there?
So my parents at that point owned multiple businesses. My father tried different things, and he had a partner at the time who at the time, I didn't know what happened. I just knew we had to leave. But later, speaking to my parents, who kind of embezzled money, stole money from the company, made a bad reputation, kind of trashed their name all throughout the city. So my father was so frustrated, he ran away on his wife, the partner, ran away on his wife and just left. And so my father was so frustrated, he said, my name's trashed here, company's trashed, we just got to get out of here. So he wanted to start all over. At the time, Korean immigrants, they didn't really know, like, either L.A., New York, Philadelphia, Atlanta were the only cities that they knew other Korean people were in. And so we were in Philadelphia, so my parents said, let's just move to Atlanta. And so they just picked up, moved to Atlanta. Gosh, I think I was in third, fourth grade.
Yeah, it was difficult for you in Atlanta, right?
It was. It was a place where I moved to. In Philadelphia, I had cousins, I had aunts, I had my grandparents, I had different people around. We knew nobody when we moved to Atlanta. And so moving to Atlanta, we didn't know anybody. Then we moved, my parents not knowing much of the community or the area, moved to a really kind of rough part of South Atlanta. And I was the only Korean kid in the community. It was...
You got roughed up quite a bit.
I did. It was actually kind of a difficult time. I look back on it. At the time, I don't think of, like, if I look back at that age, I think, oh my gosh, that's just a child. But in my mind, I didn't feel like a child in that community. You know, when I look back, even when I remember it, I still think of myself, I remember distinctly, you know, my parents worked till really late at night. So I had to cook dinner for my sister. She was in kindergarten or first grade at the time. And I used to get beat up by the neighborhood kids pretty much every day. I still distinctly remember being like intentionally tackled in the dog poop and just being different. Yeah. We were so scared that I used to walk around with a baseball bat everywhere, and we'd practice with my sister. She would carry around a jump rope. And so if somebody broke in, I'd hit him with the baseball bat, then you have to tie him up really quickly, Jennifer. And so we'd practice on her dolls. And it was a tough place. I remember at one point my mom went to the school, you know, just complaining about my son gets beat up every day from the bus ride home. Is there anything you guys can do about it? And so they said they tried to put another person on the bus, but it's just once I got off the bus, then it was over.
Religion was important to your parents. Mm-hmm. Talk about that and their involvement in the church.
Yeah, so the Korean-American culture, whether or not you were a Christian or not, the church in America became the kind of the cultural bastion of Korean-Americanism. You know, like that's you went to the church if you're a Korean in America. And so that was where my mom was a Christian. My father wasn't, but he went to church anyway and later on became a Christian. So church was an active part of their life. My mom and my dad were very active in the choir and always being part of the school. So ever since I was young, we always attended church.
And what about that for you? Because I know that it was difficult because in the Korean language, first of all, you've got these grades of language. Tone makes a difference, particularly with you talking to elders and then kind of translating.
Tenses, yeah.
Yeah. And then trying to keep up with the liturgical language.
Right.
Not easy for you.
I absolutely. I hated it.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I honestly, after leaving Philadelphia and then leaving Atlanta, I moved to a small town and the Korean churches were very small. And so I just hated going to Korean church because the language was so just difficult. I didn't understand. Yeah. I spoke Korean at more of a young child level. Like my Korean's only been with my parents. So yeah. I spoke like a child would speak to their parents. So I didn't understand the liturgical language. I didn't understand the big words, this preaching terminology. So it was just boring to me. So going to a place like, I just don't understand the words you're saying. I'm going to draw pictures. You know what I mean? It was just boring. So literally I followed my parents probably like all throughout late elementary school to middle school, like I don't want to go to church with you anymore. This is so boring to me. It's pointless.
But what were they saying?
They're like, you have to go.
You have to go. Right.
You have no choice in the matter. You go
and on. What were they? I could make the assumption that they were assuming that you would go into business. Did they have plans for you?
The only two choices were doctor, lawyer, engineer. Three choices. That's pretty much, you ask every Korean kid in America, those are like your only three choices. And I think lawyers gone down a lot more since, but back then lawyers were still really sought after in that time period. Not that there's nothing wrong being a lawyer, but I mean that's a job market.
And what were your plans when you went to college? You started to sort of develop a mind of your own, right?
Yeah, well, it was actually in high school that late high school I just felt a totally different calling. I always carried the weight, the felt the responsibility, the burden to be very financially successful. That was something that my parents instilled upon me. I was a dishwasher, bus boy. I did all the odd jobs. So knowing what hard work looked like, always felt the burden to just what makes a lot of money. And so that was always my desire, is how do I be financially successful so I can take care of my family.
And your parents had a lot of businesses. I mean, talk about the various businesses they were involved in, right?
Yeah, they had a sub shop, a little grocery market. They had a little Chinese takeout restaurant, and they had dry cleaners.
Wow. And yeah. So you're doing all that. So talk about in high school then, what's going through your mind? You said you knew you had to be successful in business. Did you have any particular plans?
Yeah, I don't know why. Somehow it came to my mind. I said the idea of being a corporate lawyer was it. Because I knew I was a little bit more prone to humanities and language and social, and rather than the mathematics and science. So I was like, I'm going to go that route, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was, oh, my parents hated that. They're like, oh, why go that route? Okay, I guess you can be a lawyer, but doctors are just more safe.
Oh, I see. Yeah. But they thought the corporate lawyer was somehow a risky profession.
Well, I mean, they thought that was okay, but they were just like, doctors are better. Engineers are safer.
Talking to Lawrence Yu today, lead pastor at Waypoint Church, co-owner of Sushioki Restaurant. We'll talk about how all of that came together out of this and much, much more on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, which is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to Lawrence Yu today, who did not always know he wanted to be a minister. For a time, he didn't even go to church. But today, he's lead pastor at Waypoint Church in the Triangle and the co-owner of Sushioki Restaurant in Durham. And those two things are related. We'll talk about that. Lawrence believes that there is value in combining ministry and entrepreneurship. His restaurant provides a living wage as well as flexible job opportunities for the refugee community in this area, and he hopes others will apply the philosophy to their businesses as well. So we talked about Atlanta and a little bit about sort of what your parents and expectations, their expectations for you, and it was not easy for anybody in Atlanta, apparently. Your parents eventually moved to Florida, right?
They did, yes. So my father, my older sister, lived in Atlanta, lived in Panama City, Florida, which is, we've never heard of Panama City Beach, Florida. So they said, come visit us for a trip. So we went one trip, and it was beautiful, but it was the opposite of Atlanta and Philadelphia. But Atlanta was so difficult that we just decided to move.
Yeah.
And so as a family, we moved to Panama City Beach and started all over there. My father worked as a line chef at a takeout restaurant. My mother worked as a waitress at a Chinese kind of Chinese restaurant type area. I still actually distinctly remember this day. The amount is what blows my mind. I remember my mom worked a double shift, came home one night, and she reached in and she took out $90. And she looked at me and said, look how much money. She was so excited. Look how much money I made. I worked all morning from 9 in the morning till 11 at night, and I made $90. And she was so excited. And for me, I just remember thinking about, like looking back now, I'm like, wow. My parents worked hard.
Yeah. Did that, know? I mean, at the time, that might have seemed like a lot of money to
it
you,
did.
Too.
Oh, right? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, clearly, it seemed like so much money to me at the time.
Well, what was that transition like for you? I mean, obviously, they were prepared to go in and do the work and do whatever it took.
I was actually excited. I was ready for it. Atlanta was really difficult for me and my sister. And so I was really ready and excited to start over as well.
And they did that work and built some capital and then got their own business again.
Right. So they did. They worked hard to get some capital, and then they bought the restaurant where my father was working at. Wow. And so they took over that restaurant.
Socially, things worked out better for you. Instead of getting beat up every day after school, you actually joined a team.
Well, it was actually funny that I remember distinctly moving into Panama City Beach and thinking, oh, wait a minute, these guys are soft compared to Atlanta. South Atlanta versus Panama City Beach, it's a whole different ballgame.
You can roll these guys.
Yeah, I walked into the playground and said, oh, wait a minute. This is not bad.
So talk more about that, because that was
actually
different.
What ended up happening is it was a different place where I went from being, there's a ton of minorities, to kind of what we call Lower Alabama, to not very many minorities. And so it was also kind of interesting finding my place. You know, being Korean American in a place where there are not many Korean American people, even because I was on the beach side with not many non-white people, you know, majority white population. What ended up happening is, I still remember this, in the seventh grade, I started getting really into basketball. And there's a group of guys that were all in something called the Quest program, which is kind of like a gifted program. And we all got into basketball together at the same time. And us guys just played basketball. That's what we did. We played basketball every day, before school, after school. We just played basketball together. And we all became best friends. And these are actually the same. We chose to go to the same high school together. We all chose to do a program called International Baccalaureate Program together in high school, which was a different high school that we had to go to, that we were not zoned for. And then we all chose to go to University of Florida together. And we were all groomsmen in each other's weddings.
Wow. So you stayed together.
We still, to this day, get together once a year on a trip. We call it kind of like a guy's trip that we get together.
And members of that group were important to you because at this point, as you said, religion was, you were just bored by it all. You were not the least bit interested, mm-hmm. but there was a transition that took place, right?
Right, yeah. There was actually a girl named Sandy Presley, my sophomore, junior year, if I can't remember which one it is, in high school. And she was constantly inviting us to join her youth group. And I finally went, and I met a man there named Leighton Lane Lockett from Lubbock, Texas.
Whoa.
I know.
That's a lot of L's.
Yeah, a lot of L's. Yeah. Crazy guy, a lot of fun, just cared for people in a passionate and tangible way. I mean, the way you could just see it in his face and the way he passionately communicated, and he just loved people. Something about it spoke to my heart. You know, this sense of belonging, a sense of not being cast out, not being the different one, you know? I yearned for that, but didn't really, you know, I kind of went, something connected, but just wasn't fully connected. Right. I remember one day I went to lunch with Sandy and a bunch of other friends, and he was there, and he said, "Hey, Lawrence, you and your best friend, we paid for you, the church is covering you, you're going on this weekend event, retreat with us." And I said, that was a big deal financially, if you're paying for me to go somewhere, because we never went. I never went on vacations. I've never been to Disney. I've never been to any of these type things, you know? And so I said, okay. I found later on that actually Sandy paid for me and my best friend. She planned the whole thing out, but she knew I wouldn't accept it if it came from her, you know? Yeah. So she tricked us. but we went on this retreat, and that's for the first time in my life where I actually heard this idea that it's not about relationship with God was not about earning it. It's not about being good enough. It's not about looking a certain way. It wasn't about fitting in a certain way. It wasn't about being a cookie cutter thing. It was about being pursued, being known, being loved, and having purpose. And for the first time, I was like, wow, that's what it's about? Jesus did what so that I can have what? And it was just so incredible to me. It just absolutely changed my life at that point.
It's interesting to see that and that would happen in a weekend because, again, you come up with a family, they're loving, they're earnest, and they're very hardworking, but a lot of it is very much transactional. I mean, mm-hmm. they're not telling you, I only love you because you can work hard. It's not that. But much of what they do is transactional. We have to do this because I got to get the $90 and then we can... So to in a weekend realize that church, that belonging to the oneness of it all, is not about transaction. It's not about proving yourself
right.
to the world so that the world can say, I love you, and you can go to heaven.
And what
that's,
was beautiful.
That's, I mean, that's a tough transition.
It
given
is,
that
but
background.
At the same time, that was what my parents have always been showing, uh-huh. is that they were transactional in the sense of how they dealt with the world. But with us, they were willing to sacrifice and give everything, work so hard so that we can have everything. So for them, their love was so unconditional. I still remember my parents, my dad, this is early on in Philadelphia, and I remember my dad at that point was working two jobs. He was working at a steel plant and then coming home. So he'd go to steel plant at 5 in the morning, work all day. Then he'd come home, take a quick dinner, hang out with the family, then go to his next job as a line cook. And I remember one day asking him for some money because we wanted to go on, like, buy some candy or something. And I remember him reaching into his wallet and handing me money for this trip. And then I remember looking at his hands and seeing his hands for the first time, and I saw open wounds, blisters, sores. His hands from, you know, doing a walk and working steel was just broken hands. And I remember that moment in my life thinking, oh man, that's how much my dad loves me. And that's what he showed me constantly. It wasn't transactional. It was always this unconditional, self-sacrificing love. So they showed me the beginning stages of what ultimately I saw in Jesus. But my parents were the ones who ultimately showed me the shadow of that.
Wow, that's fascinating. Because, you know, there are certainly other interpretations, and they're much more rule-based, and it's about hierarchy and me telling you how to be and to get back, you know, and that, of course, is a very painful kind of a tradition. But you're now on this other path. How did you so you have this moment, you have this weekend. What were your thoughts after that?
So my life changed. I was a different guy. I at the time really kind of thought about only like, oh, I want to have fun, and you know, I always had this burden of carrying, but so I always just did well in school. But I just really dove into like, okay, how do I help the youth group? How do I serve the church? How do I get plugged in? How do I learn more? How do I grow? And so that's what I became about. My whole junior, senior year, that's what I did. Kind of dedicated my life to that. I still remember my youth minister left, Leighton Lane Lockett, left to go to California my senior year of high school. And so that whole senior year, I actually pretty much led the youth group. Mm-hmm. I you know, taught the lessons and kind of ran everything. So it was me and my group of friends, and we kind of did it all together. I had one best friend who did the worship, played the music. I had another friend who organized it all, and I was kind of like the speaker. So it was a lot of fun, but it really kind of fell into like, this is what I'm meant to do.
So you did. At that moment, the ministry's on your radar.
Absolutely. So that's what happened. My senior year of high school, I started doing this, and that's when I started feeling a call. Like, this is what I'm meant to do with my life. Nothing else fit me like this. And so I felt more and more, and then it got affirmed. More and more people kept on saying, yeah, that's it. This is what you're meant to do. And I got to the point where I realized, I don't know if I could do anything else. This is what I want to do with the rest of my life, is I want to serve in the church in this way.
So what's the pathway at that point? Did you have an idea how you do that? How do you pursue that?
Honestly, I wasn't sure. I just wasn't sure at all. I just decided, as long as I just got to go to college. That's all I know. So I go to college. Mm. Which is funny because you ever played MASH?
No.
You know what MASH is? Okay.
No.
MASH is a game.
I've seen it.
Yeah, MASH is a game kids would play. And I think the MASH stands for Mansion Apartment Shack House. And so what they would do is they'd pick three girls' names so that who you want to marry one day, or three jobs that you want to have one day, and three whatever. And then you kind of go through, oh, you're going to end up being in this, married to this, going to this, you know? Yeah. It's a kid's game that you would play. And I remember always choosing for my professions on there, I would choose ninja. Always wanted to be a ninja.
There's money in that, actually.
I mean, very good money. High demand. I always wanted to be a ninja. I always wanted to be wealthy. So yeah. I always chose corporate lawyer. So ninja, corporate lawyer. But I still distinctly remember, even when I was young, before I even went to church and started going back to church, I remembered my mother's sister, so my aunt, told my mom that, you know, Lawrence is so loved by his family. He's just, and that's the type of person that needs to be a pastor. Somebody who's just received a lot of love. And so that always stuck in my mind. So as a kid, that was always my third choice. I didn't know what else to do. I was going to say, I've always dead set on being a ninja or a corporate lawyer, so the third thing didn't matter. So I always said pastor as my MASH list. So even when I applied to colleges, I always said, okay, I'm going to apply for those three jobs in mind.
So getting back to MASH, how did that turn out? What was your forecast after
Well, they've always been different.
But where does that lead you?
I ended up being one of them, so I guess it works.
It kind of worked. You ended up, you did the youth ministry, and then you went to the University of Florida, right?
I did. I went to the University of Florida, and that was that was one of the choices because I got, you know, it was free. So I figured in the ministry, go to where college is free.
Good choice.
Yeah. And the University of Florida is great. Go Gators. Yeah.
So what were you going to do there? What do you then think about going to the seminary after that, or what do you take in your undergrad?
So I just took a basic liberal arts degree initially because I was convincing my parents I could still do law school.
Yeah. let me ask you about that. When you told them you were going to be a minister.
That was rough.
Yeah.
I still remember, I didn't tell them until later on. Yeah. I didn't tell them until I was in college. And they hated it. They really hated it. But the first thing my mom said to me was, why don't you just be a lawyer first? Then you can be a minister.
Yeah.
Make a lot of money. You can still do it. What's the problem?
Right.
And so they just hated the idea of it. They just, like, you know, Lawrence, you're never going to have enough money. You know, you're not going to be able to take care of us. This is not what you want to do.
Did you understand that at the time?
I did. And it was hard for me. I this is countless hours of prayer, of talking to my friends, of just knowing that it was going to be difficult. Yeah. I didn't want to let them down.
No, I mean,
they gave me everything.
You know it's coming from a place of love. Absolutely.
Right.
But you also want them to accept what you're doing. Right?
And I told them, I said, you know, I don't need much, so I'll give you everything else. And they're like, they tell me they don't want it for them. They said, we're okay. We just don't want you to have to work hard. Mm-hmm. We know how hard financial strife is on a marriage, on a person. We don't want you to have that. And so it was a process, a gradual process. And finally, my mom said something that was just really hit me. Was she said, "All right, Lawrence, you're gonna be in the ministry. Okay, that's fine. You better get better at Korean. Your Korean's not good enough." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" She says, "Well, you wanna be in the ministry, right? So you're gonna go work at a Korean church." And so your Korean is just not good enough. You can't preach in Korean. So you really got to practice Korean. And I said, well, why can't I not work at a Korean? Well, she says, no white church will ever hire you as your lead pastor. Hmm. It just won't happen. She's never seen it before. She's never heard of it before. She says the only pastors she's ever known that are Korean are all in Korean churches. And so maybe you might be able to get a job maybe as a youth minister, maybe somebody at a white majority white church, but you're never going to be the head pastor at a white church.
And a bit of foreshadowing because that turned out to be— pretty accurate advice.
It is accurate, yeah.
We'll get to that in just a minute. But you had that scholarship you talked about, but then you lost it. What happened?
Oh, I was not very smart. Not good at time management. School always came really easy to me. I love taking tests, which is, I'm a weirdo. I love taking tests. I loved, school was always easy to me. I read really fast. And so I got to the point where I got a job as a youth minister. So when I first started college, I was a pretentious college student. I thought me and my friends were the holy ones that knew how to do, were the passionate ones who cared about reaching people and loving people well, and all the older people didn't know what they were doing. And so we got really excited about starting our own ministries, and we had a little Bible study that would gather together, and a bunch of people would join us, and we'd go worship out on the campus, and people would join us, and I'd speak and share, and it was just going really well. But I got told by a pastor that I really respected. He said, you know, you doing your own thing, your own passionate thing, is not what you're called to do. You're supposed to be part of a local body, people of all ages, of all types together, coming together, taking accountability for each other, teach each other, be wisdom for each other. And you just getting people who are like-minded that you can, that's more of a cult. And I said, wow. Okay.
Did you say that right away? Because I can imagine, look, you're filled with passion. You believe that this is an inspiration from God. You've got a new understanding of this passionate ministry now. And it's coming from God. And now this minister says, hold it, slow down. You're in the wrong direction. How did you take that advice at first?
Honestly, it hit me hard. I didn't want to listen to it, but I really respected him. Yeah. He's always been somebody that was really close to me, down to earth. Never somebody who was out for his own agenda, just somebody who only cared about me. And so I said, okay.
So what do you do next?
So actually we stopped our outside church ministry, and then I spoke at an event where a local pastor heard me speak at and asked me to become their youth minister and get plugged into a local church. So I became a youth minister at the end of my freshman year of college, and so I started serving at that church. And that was my first paid staff ministry position.
What did you do after you graduated?
So I actually went back to my hometown to help my parents out. They were in a position of transitioning. The restaurant that they owned at the time was in a shopping center where there was a huge Walmart and a huge grocery store. And so that was great. They were doing really well. But then the Walmart grocery store left, and they built a brand new shopping center down the road, but they wouldn't let anybody else back in because they still owned the lease. And so they were okay paying the lease because they're Walmart and they're your big grocery store.
Right.
And so the shopping center basically died. Wow. And so my parents' restaurant went from doing well to dead. Because once Walmart and the grocery store leaves. Yeah. So they didn't know what to do. So we transitioned out of that. And they decided to transition into opening a dry cleaners. But that took a while of selling their house, moving to apartments. I actually moved into an apartment with them for a little while. Then I had to live by myself. I just couldn't do it.
And what happened to that youth ministry? Because you were very excited at first, but then you hit a little bump in the road.
Yeah, so that was my first job after college. It was back in Panama City. When I was first hired by the pastor who hired me there, the reason I took the job was he was just a wonderful guy. But he actually left 2 months after I was there. He had offered a wonderful position. I don't fault him for it. You know, he left to do something that he was passionately pursued to do. But they hired a new pastor, and the very first day, I was 21 years old, and the very first day the new pastor came on, I was asked to preach that Sunday morning. So I preached that Sunday morning. He came into the office on that Monday after, called me in and said, I don't ever want you to preach again. And I said, oh, and he was a late 40s kind of guy. And I said, well, why not? Did I do something wrong? And he says, I don't need people comparing me to you.
Wow.
And I was just like, oh, well, okay. I was very Asian in me. I was very, okay, you're the authority. I'll follow along. And that church, we grew. God did some amazing things in that body. But it was a really rough experience because later on found out that pastor's wife left. He was having an affair. He took money from the youth ministry. I mean, it was a bad situation. And that gave me my truly first really negative bad taste of ministry and church life.
What was that like for you? I mean, what was that like? How do you square that with?
It was difficult. It was tough. I mean, I was 23 and I don't think I was truly naive. I wasn't, you know, so innocent and naive that I didn't get that life, but it really showed me more and more though that we all need grace. And I know what I'm capable of doing. And so I didn't want to be too harsh in my judgment, but at the same time, I always wanted the church to be better than that.
Talking to Lawrence Yu today, lead pastor at Waypoint Church now in the Triangle, and we're going to find out about his business opportunities as well and inroads to assisting the refugee community. All of that when the state of things continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and I'm talking to Lawrence Yu today, the lead pastor of Waypoint Church in the Triangle, co-owner of Sushioki. It's a restaurant in Durham that provides flexible living wage jobs for refugees and a model that he hopes to see other entrepreneurs recreate and make some change in the area. So we talked about you had some conflict with then the pastor at a church in Panama City Beach in Florida, and you left that ministry, right?
I did. And after that, I went to seminary. I went to Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando. But before that, I spent a little bit of time, because of the timing of the semester and everything when it started, I spent some time in South Korea, actually. I didn't have any money at the point, and my parents said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll help support you a little bit going to seminary, but we want you to go and take this almost healing time. Hmm. I got to live with my uncle and be a tutor for his daughters, basically, in English in school. And they were in high school, middle school at the time. And it was actually a...
How long were you there?
Almost 3 months.
Had you been there before?
No. Well, actually, yes, as a kid.
Yeah.
But this is my first time really that I can remember being there.
What was that like for you? In this, you're being really highly dislocated at this moment, and now you're sort of at the roots of your cultural tradition.
It was honestly a healing time for me because my uncle had a house in the mountains, and I would wake up in the morning, and I would go walk the mountain and go walk up and down. Then I would read... tutor the girls, work out, read some more, walk the mountain some more. I really almost lived a... It was just so... If people who know me, they're like, that's not Lawrence. <You know? laughs> He's like, he didn't have people all around and he wasn't hanging out with people all the time. That was just not my experience. But it was a great time for me. It's what I really needed at that time in my life.
How so, and what did it do for you?
So at the time, that I just said that I just left that terrible ministry position, and it was something that really affected me emotionally, hurt my heart. I love the kids. Anytime you leave a ministry where you invested in the youth and the children, it wrecks you, you know, emotionally, because you're so connected and you love them so much and you invest so much. And then on top of that, the reason why I left, the pastor, who was just such a difficult situation. Yeah. So I had to process all of that. I had to process still that there's a saying, I don't remember who said it. I remember a singer saying it. So I don't know if he got it from somewhere else. But he was talking about the church and saying, yeah, the church is dirty. The church is a whore, but she's my mom. Mm-hmm. You know, this idea that, yeah, she's... But we love her, and we're connected. We're part supposed to be together, and so really processing all of that as well.
Was there a way to? And I don't know what it was like to connect, or whether you had enough time to connect with a cultural tradition that you had not known in
its
home base.
Yeah.
And I wonder what that.
Well, so my Korean got really good.
Yeah, there you go.
I was communicating Korean, traveling around in Korean. It was really interesting because what I got to see also is I was staying with my uncle. But I also had other cousins and aunts, and I had a grandfather who was still in Korea. So I got to visit all of them. I got to see. It was really interesting. My aunt, who's the longest working in the ministry position in this oldest church, first Protestant church in Korea, she was the oldest staff member there. So introduced me to one of the leading pastors in the area, and I just remember thinking, okay, I'm just gonna wear nice slacks and a button-up shirt. She said no. It's a lunch meeting, so you have to wear a suit. I was shocked. I said, what? Like, yeah, in Korea, that's what we're known for, is you have to dress up for everything. So I was like, I had no idea, because in America, I wear shorts and a T-shirt everywhere.
<That's right.
laughs> Flip-flops are okay.
That's right. Shoes are optional, right?
Yeah.
So you do that. You take that time. You went to seminary then. Talk about that experience, because you got a job, too.
I did. So I loved seminary. Seminary was incredible. It was a great learning time, great community of people. But I started going and thinking, I don't want another job in ministry right away. I just wanted to be a student for a little while, because that was my problem at undergrad. Is I became a ministry right away. I didn't study as hard. So I just wanted to be a student. So my first semester, I just studied, was a student. But I spoke at an event, because I was obviously willing to, if people asked me to speak, I was like, oh yeah, I could use extra money. So I definitely speak at an event. Plus, I love speaking and teaching. Spoke at an event, and a pastor again heard me and says, hey, we desperately need a youth minister, please. And I said, no. But he said, tell you what, I'll buy you dinner. Just come on out.
And you can wear shorts.
Exactly. Sorry. So I'll buy you dinner. Just meet the kids. Just meet them. I should have known that was a trap. So I met the kids, and it was a small church in Sanford, Florida. Very small church. First United Methodist Church of Sanford. And they had only 3 or 4 kids there. And I met them, and they were like, please. And I said, I can't say no. So I became the youth minister there. And it was such a wonderful experience. I don't know if you know much about Sanford. We kind of jokingly call it the armpit of Orlando.
Yeah, not that's nice Sanford, North Carolina.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's the only one I know.
They, it was a really racially diverse location. You can see the line. You can see where the division is in Sanford. I mean, it was so clear to see. And our church was kind of like on the border of that line. And so what became beautiful, this is the first time for me to have a radically diverse ministry. So the church was kind of an older church. And so on Sunday morning, they might have 80 to 120 adults, majority white. Our youth ministry got to the point where we had 80 kids, and they were half and half. Like, we had a diverse youth ministry, which was so wonderful to see. But I'll be honest, I loved that time, but it was a difficult time. We saw some incredibly difficult situations in that context. You know, I had twin girls who, when I met them, they were in 6th grade, but they were dating 19-year-olds. Their mother was a prostitute who, you know, but man, seeing them, seeing their lives change was just so incredible. You know, I had a 6th grade girl who was snatched off the street and held for over a day and then just thrown back onto the street. It was difficult. It was a difficult, difficult time.
Did you feel equipped? I mean, that's some real trauma there, and you're expected to be the one who's got the healing powers. You're the minister after all, but boy, this is some real heavy-duty, high-powered stuff.
No. I never felt equipped, but I felt called. And I feel like that's one of the things I tell our people is that, you know, God doesn't call the equipped. He equips the called. Mm. And so... I'd never felt equipped, but he gave me all that I needed at the time.
Well, you did move on eventually and decided to look for jobs. You thought you wanted to go to a big city.
Yeah, I wanted to live in California. That was like the idea, or New York. I wanted to live in San Francisco, San Diego, L.A., or New York, because I just thought my sister lived in California at this time. She went to undergrad in California. Mm-hmm. So she's like, Lawrence, can I just tell you, it's different. You know, it's just different being Asian in California than it is being Asian in the Southeast. And it just is. And she's like, Lawrence, you just got to experience this. Yeah. And so I was like, okay, I want to experience this. I want to go. I want to see what that's like. I want to feel what it's like not necessarily always standing out and being the token minority or the, you know, the one that's like, hey, I met a Korean girl or I met an Asian girl. You should date her. You know?
In fact, you probably know her.
Right. Yeah. Don't you know her already? And so just wanted to experience that. I wanted to feel that. So I applied for jobs in these major cities. Honestly, I applied to a job in Raleigh just – because somebody mentioned there's a job in Raleigh, and I figured that's what you do when you apply for jobs. You send it out everywhere. But never actually considered moving to Raleigh. Didn't even know where Raleigh was, honestly.
But you got here.
But it was incredible. I came here for an interview. Very same day I flew out for an interview here, I got offered a job in San Francisco that I wanted. But so I came in thinking, well, free trip to Raleigh. So I'll take this job in San Francisco. There was something I just felt like this is where I needed to be. It was an incredible experience.
Do you have any idea what that was? Was it...
And part of it, I think, was the passion of the people interviewing me. Yeah. They were so desperate. I had one of the guys interviewing me, wonderful man. He looked at me and literally said, if you don't take this job, tell me where you're going, and I'll move my family to where you're going. Oh. So I just said, wow, you guys really want me here. And so that was part of it. I just feel like God, but also I think it was just God's like, this is where you need to be.
So you got some work here, and then your mother's prediction came true. About getting a church in an established church as a Korean, right?
Well, yes. So I was an associate pastor at that church. It was a majority white church.
Right.
But I was not the head pastor, right. Lead pastor. Yeah. I was majority just youth ministry, next gen ministry. And I was working there for a while. It was a majority white, wealthy church, which is so different from where I was just from.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we came from my old church. We had a budget of $1,000 for 70 kids to I had a budget of $80,000. It was just a whole different ball game. And if I needed anything, I could do a fundraiser like that and raise $50,000 at the new church. You know, if we need anything. My old church, I was like begging people. I was begging all my friends and professors to come to a fundraiser. You know, like we need something. So it was a totally different ballgame. And I didn't think I wanted that, but God used it to teach me a lot. I think part of it is because he wanted me, my wife and I, to get together, because that was how we got together too. So it was very interesting that way. But yeah, and then, but towards the end of that time, and I loved my time at that church. It was a wonderful time. But I just really felt called to be a part of a church that showed the good news, the gospel of Jesus, as something more powerful than we kind of seem to show it to be on the church in the South. You know, I always joke, I joke about this, but I always often talk to my friends about this. But I feel like in the South, the church and the good news of the gospel seems to be only good enough news to bring people who already are similar together. Mm. You know, it's not powerful enough to break through truly racial and social economic barriors. I just
That's in a sense, it becomes a form of social identity. I mean, it shouldn't be surprising. This is the thing we use to identify ourselves as white. We have these rules. These are our rules of virtue, and we will call you out. And again, this becomes a transactional kind of religion, a transactional relationship with God. So if that's what you've got, you're gonna have people who look like you.
Exactly.
That's the point.
And part of it also is just, it makes sense. It's easy. I know a lot of the Korean American community, especially second generation, who speak perfect English, still like to be amongst Korean Americans And I get that. There's an ease to that. But I wanted to say, can the good news show purposefully, show us doing the difficult thing because it's worth more?
Well, talk about that, the founding of Waypoint Church.
Yeah. So we founded Waypoint Church with this idea that church kind of has a twofold purpose. First purpose is that we want to be the coming attraction, the kind of the preview of what the kingdom of heaven looks like. You know, so this idea of you watch a preview for a movie, at least for me, I love trailers. I'm like, yes, that's hilarious. I want to watch that movie. I love that action sequence.
That's my heaven. I'm going there.
That's what I want. And so what we want to do is like, hey, we believe the kingdom of heaven is a diverse, radically diverse place. People of every tribe, ethnicity, tongue, nation together. And so because of that, we want to look like that. We want people to look at that and be like, oh, wow, there's a group of people who are – They're white, they're black, they're Latin American, they're from Taiwan, they're from Japan, they're from Haiti, they're from wherever, and they're all together, and somehow they get along in this climate.
And where is the church?
Our church right now?
Yeah, right now.
It's kind of the border of Durham and Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm. So you've got all kinds of boundaries that you're straddling here. And then talk about the decision then to start a restaurant and how that plays into all of this.
So I was on the board of World Relief. And so I really helped, really, really involved with the kind of the refugee community. And actually, as a matter of fact, our church, every one of our small groups is a good neighbor team with World Relief. And what that was is when the refugees were coming at a higher number, we would be one of the teams. A good neighbor team is someone who furnishes an apartment, meets the family that comes in at the airport, welcomes them in, and then basically lives life with them for the next year. You know, how to ride the bus, how to do your laundry, cultural stigmas and cultural identity issues that you're walking through, school, relationships, parents, conferences, all that kind of stuff. And so all of our whole church was heavily involved in this ministry. And so one of the things I've discovered in being so involved is jobs are hard. Especially jobs that are flexible, that pay well. But, you know, if you have somebody who has five kids and, you know, they need a job, but, you know, their kid says, I'm sick. Yeah. That's just tough.
Well, and if you're a refugee, there's probably some trauma in your background that you're still dealing with.
You're exactly right.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
So a restaurant. Tell me more.
Yeah. So growing up, we always did large handheld rolls. We didn't call them sushi rolls. In Korea, they're called kimbap. And just seaweed wrapped with vegetable, meat, rice in this roll. And they'd cut them up into little circles like you consider sushi rolls. But I'd always just grab them before my mom cut them up.
Like a burrito.
Yeah, I was just, this is mine. You know, like a big hoagie or burrito, you know? And I would just eat them. And I thought, that's a great concept. And then I went to California and saw somebody kind of doing a similar concept. They did a lot of fusion of Latin American and Japanese flavors to make sushi burritos. Well, ours is not so much a Latin American fusion. It's more Pan-Asian kind of – well, actually, not just Pan-Asian. We have something called Southern Sushi where it's actually smoked pork barbecue.
Now you're talking.
Yeah, with creamy coleslaw and our pork rinds that we make in-house in a roll.
Yeah.
And so we're like, let's just try it. And it turns out great.
So but talk about the paying a living wage and the flexible hours. I mean, this is the hard part for any business. How do you do it?
It's a lot of work on our manager. The manager really stresses out and tries to figure out work schedules. We have people who are able to work at different hours, try to be really flexible in their work schedules. But realistically, it is tough. If you're not really successful, it's tough to pay that much because you're not making the money. But what's beneficial for us, what's great for us, is that both me and my partner, we don't need the income. We don't need it to be a highly profitable business yet. Don't get me wrong. We want it to be profitable.
Right. You got to make more money at the end of the week than you spend.
Exactly. Yeah. We're not here to lose money.
All right.
But we can make it a living wage because it's not our sole source of income. Now, if we were both working there full time, it might be a hard time. But then we'd be the ones working there, so we might actually be okay. But yeah, we were so passionate about providing living wage, flexible workouts. But we also thought it's a model that works. We have low overhead costs overall, other than staffing. You know, you create a system that's low overhead other than staffing, then if we make a certain amount of production, a certain amount of business, we're going to make a large profit, even with paying our people so well. So we believed in an excellent product. We believe in people who say they'll go support people who are doing this. If that's the case, then we think there's profit enough for everybody.
What do your parents think about all this?
They thought it was crazy.
Yeah.
They said, Lawrence, we worked hard so that you didn't have to do business. You didn't have to do a restaurant business.
And now you're doing it. Yeah. What's the future? What are you looking forward to?
I would love to start others.
Yeah.
We just want to provide more jobs. I just love being able to provide more jobs for people. You know, I love it when World Relief can call me up and say, hey, we got somebody who needs a job. I love it when somebody who's been working for us gets offered a better job. You know, I
yeah,
just
what about
that
training or pathways to management and
oh, yeah.
Entrepreneurship?
So Leticia, for example, was with us from the very beginning, a year and a half in. She's now our kitchen manager. So she gets paid as a manager. She gets health insurance. So it's a beautiful retirement. So that's a beautiful system. But we also love like entry-level workers. We still get paid a living wage, but they get trained up and work. Their resume now looks a lot better. Mm. So we had two guys, Greg and Emmanuel, who worked for us. Now they get paid a job that's more a little bit more physical manual labor, but they get paid more. But they learned how to show up on time. They learned how to, you know, work a basic job and build up the resume.
Lawrence Yu, lead pastor at Waypoint Church, co-owner of Sushioki Restaurant in Durham. We've got links to all of that at our website, stateofthings.org. Lawrence, thank you so much. Great to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Great being here.
As I said, check our website for more Movies on the Radio. Your favorite line, the one-liner from the movies, make my day. A bit of dialogue that stands out for you. Send us an email at sot@wnc.org or tweet us at #SOTMovie to be on the next Movies on the Radio. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hollab-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Taras is our intern, and North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.